The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Tonight what I want to talk about is talking about the art of spiritual growth. In other words, we can look at the title, The Art of Spiritual Growth, and what I plan to do in the next 6 weeks is really analyze that whole title. What is art? What is spiritual? What is growth? But before I go into the details of all that, I want to first look at the statement in general and the relationship the statement, the art of spiritual growth, has to the reality of the growth itself. And so tonight what I want to talk about is words, thinking, silence, and the way they relate to reality. And I realized as I was working on this today that I really have a lot to say about silence, and I thought that was kind of strange, you know? There's just so much to say about silence, and I hope you understand that statement a little better by the end also. And so, just as a little introduction, I remember years ago, I was walking with my son in the Rova. I live in the old city of Jerusalem. And my son at that time was two and a half, three, just at the stage where they're really becoming aware, but you're teaching them words. So we're walking down the street, and my son looks up, and there, flying across the sky, is this thing, and he looks up, and he goes, Abba! Zeh! You know? And so I look up, he's in such awe, and I turn to him, I say, that's a bird. You know? And my son looks at me, says, bird. I said, that's right. That's a bird. He goes, ah, okay. See? And I felt really good. I taught him what that was. That's a bird. And then we're walking down the street, and then a couple minutes later, another one flies by, and my son looks and goes, ah, Abba, there! So I say, that's a bird. That's also a bird. And I realized he looked at me with such shock, like, that's also a bird? How could that also be a bird? And when I looked in the eyes of my son, that shock that he had, in realizing that those two absolutely different objects or things or creatures are both called birds, and the almost disbelief in his eyes, I began to realize who sees and who doesn't see. He sees Zeh. I don't even know what he sees anymore. I realize that I've become so accustomed when I look up, I say, birds, birds, birds. I lose touch with the reality of what it is I'm looking at because I have such a clear and quick definition and description of what it is before I even see it. Children come into the world and they see the world before the word, before the concept. And then as we're growing up, we learn to identify certain concepts and certain words with that reality. But the danger of that all, the conceptualization, the formulation and the speaking, is that we all of a sudden begin to think that is a bird, rather than that's what we call it. And so the first step in spiritual growth is to be able to distinguish the difference between thinking, speaking, and experiencing reality. And if we can come to an understanding of the relationship between those, then we really have the first step in spiritual growth. And so what I'd like to first talk about is the dangers of talking about spiritual growth. I want to talk about the dangers of thinking about spiritual growth, of philosophizing about spiritual growth. And by the end of this, no one will come next week, right? Isn't that a great idea? But there really is a problem. There really is a problem. And basically, I've broken it down into four categories. Thinking and speaking about reality, about life, has a tendency to substituting life. That's number one. Thinking and speaking about life has a tendency of disconnecting ourselves from life. Thinking and speaking about life causes forgetfulness, and thinking and speaking about life actually causes much pain. Those are the four areas I want to explore. And then, of course, once I've explored the dangers of thinking and speaking about life and spiritual growth, I then hopefully will convince you why then must we do it anyways. And then hopefully you'll come back next week. Okay. So the first problem. When we think about life, and when we speak about life, and growth, and love, and meaning, and God, what we have a tendency of doing is deluding ourselves that because we are speaking about it, we are involved in it. Because we understand it, we are actually living it and experiencing it. And this, after being involved in education for 15 years, I began to see this is a major problem. One of the things that always used to bother me when I would do Israelites is you could be teaching this very deep, beautiful, sensitive ideas, and then for some reason, right after class, people do things that just seem so incongruent with what you were just talking about. And he said, how is that possible? And people were taking notes, and people were nodding their heads, and people coming up to you and say, that was terrific, and I understood that. And yet, even though they understood that, you can't understand why then their behavior is just has nothing to do with that. And then I started to think also back into my own years in learning in yeshiva. And I remember one of the most disturbing things, and I'm sure, unfortunately, you've had this experience too, where you meet somebody who's very involved in the study of Torah. It might even be their day-long, you know, investment. And yet, for some reason, the way they live their life doesn't seem to match the intensity and the commitment that their learning has. And you start to wonder how that's possible. But I realize it's very possible. In fact, not only possible, but it's one of the dangers of learning about life. That you begin to think that because you're learning about it, you're living it. Because it simulates it. You have a sense that since I conceptually, philosophically understand life and responsibilities in life and the meaning of relationships between people, that somehow I have fulfilled that. Somehow I'm living that. But I'm not living that at all. I just happen to understand it. But a person who doesn't understand it, they can't delude themselves to think they're living it. But a person who does understand it begins to think, well, if I understand it, then obviously I live it. Obviously I'm doing it. There's an interesting piece in the Talmud. The Talmud says, Lo halimud ha'ikar ela maaseh. The study is not the essence, but the action. Now, you know, if you know anything about Torah and Judaism, one would say that, isn't that a little obvious? I mean, it's a little obvious, right? I mean, obviously we're learning in order to do so that we do what we're supposed to do. And yet, so why would the Talmud have to say something that seems so absolutely obvious? Right? It's not the learning that's the essence, but it's the doing. Because since we're learning Torah, it's so easy to start to think that you're actually living it because you're learning it. Because you're learning it, you assume, yes, you are living it. And therefore the Talmud has to tell me, don't make that mistake and substitute your learning, your thinking, you're talking about life, about values, about relationships. Don't come to think that you are actually fulfilling that and that you're actually living that. Because it's so easy to make that mistake. That's why we are told that Torah in Derech Eretz, Torah with the way of the world, living in the world, must go together. And that kind of seems a little strange. I need the Torah to tell me that I have to bring Torah into my social life and into my business life and into my agricultural life and into my political life. I mean, if that's not Torah, then what is? So why would they, again, why would the Torah, why would the Talmud have to make this point that you need Torah with Derech Eretz, involvement in the world? Because it's so easy that when a person's studying Torah, once again they think they're living it. They're breathing it. Only because they're actually learning it, but they have not yet lived it. And therefore we're also told that it's important to have Torah and Milacha. That a person should not only study Torah, but they should have some kind of Milacha, some kind of skilled work. Now, I saw a very interesting pshat, a very interesting commentary. The Ruach Chaim explains that let's say you're absolutely wealthy as can be, and you really don't need to make a living. You could sit and learn Torah all day long. The Ruach Chaim explains that even then you should take time to do some kind of physical, manual labor. Why? Because once again, the study of Torah, which is the study of life, and the philosophizing of life, and the exploring of life, can come as a substitute for living it. And then what happens is a person becomes more and more divorced from it. So what happens? Once you get back into life, that skill itself, whether it's writing, or whether it's building, or whether it's cleaning, you know, sometimes for me, after a long day of learning, for me, it's just a pleasure. Right now, I don't want my wife to hear this, to even wash the dishes sometimes. Right? Why? You know, because when you wash the dishes, all of a sudden, it brings you right down. If you can't wash the dishes with the Torah consciousness, then what are you talking about? You know? And I remember I once saw over somebody's sink, it says, I'd rather be learning Torah. Right? Now that is such the opposite of what Torah is. How could you rather be learning Torah when in fact you're living it right now? If you have a responsibility to do dishes, that's Torah. Why isn't that Torah? That's what it's all about. Torah is the form. Life is the substance. And we are to take the substance of life and give it the form of Torah. That's why Torah is referred to as a blueprint of reality. The blueprint is abstract, but that abstract has to become realized and materialized in this very real world. And therefore I see and I have found and I've experienced in myself the tendency whereby studying Torah, studying philosophy, thinking, talking, all can so easily substitute for really living it. And therefore we have in the Shema, it says, V'dibarta bam, you shall speak in them, not about them. There's a big difference between speaking in Torah, you're into it, and speaking about Torah, which is, yeah, really, it's just a subject, and you have this distance from it. And therefore, I remember how shocked I was when one of my colleagues told me that he enjoys more talking about Shabbos than celebrating Shabbos. And I thought, that's so strange. He said, I love to get up and talk about the meaning of Shabbos and the purpose of Shabbos and the spiritual experience of Shabbat. But I, quite frankly, don't so much enjoy Shabbat. Now, how's that possible? How can some enjoy so much talking about it, but don't enjoy living it? Because once again, it's so easy to fool yourself to think that since I'm talking about it, I'm really talking in it. Since I'm learning it, I'm actually living it. And therefore, I realize that those of us who study Torah are actually, in many ways, the most vulnerable and the most susceptible to not live it. And isn't that frightening? It was frightening to me when I thought of it. But then I realized something, which I'm a little embarrassed to tell you, but I'll tell you anyways. It's not about myself, so I'm not so embarrassed. But I remember when I was in a particular yeshiva, and again, God forbid, I'm not knocking yeshiva, but in this particular case, there was something that happened in yeshiva that I found absolutely annoying. I was in this yeshiva, and there was this problem. Again, it's a little uncomfortable to talk about, but this problem was that guys were urinating on the toilet seats. And it was like strange. It was really strange. It was sick. You were in yeshiva. People are studying Torah, and there's this phenomena of people not raising up the seat and leaving it and urinating on it. Well, so we went to the mashgiach. You would think, do we need to talk about this? I mean, we are people who are studying Torah. We know the Tosfos. We know the Mishnah Brura. We know Midrash. We know Chumash. I mean, we're talking all day about our relationship to Hashem. How is it possible that something so simple as that is a common sensitivity that, you know, a little hygiene and consideration for your fellow person, how could that be missing? And the strange thing is that they put up moda'ot, they put up signs, please don't urinate on the toilet seat. It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. What was even more crazy is when one of the heads of the yeshiva had to get up finally and give a class. And he actually brought sources to demonstrate why this was inappropriate. I thought, this is crazy. I need a source? You have to show me a source that says it's brought down, you know, and then there's a, you know, and there's a shiloh, you know, there's a, it depends on the shiur. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I remember how overwhelmed I was and how disappointed I was. I thought, how is this possible? How is this possible? We're all sitting learning Torah, right? And this is this phenomenon, you know, could be one guy with a real bladder problem, but then the guy in the kavshut. But, you know, a real serious problem whereby now we have to have a rabbi tell us that, which should have obviously been the obvious of living our lives. But once again, unfortunately, this can happen. We are warned that this can happen. That the thinking about values and morals and relationships and our relationship to God and our speaking about values and relationships and our spiritual growth, all that can so easily fool us. Whereby we begin to think, well, we're living it because we're talking about it so much. We're living it because we understand it so clearly. And so precisely those who talk about it, philosophize about it, are the ones who really have to be very, very careful about it. And so, the first danger of talking about spiritual growth and thinking about spiritual growth is the danger of actually thinking that, look, we're involved in spiritual growth. Look at that. We've just done spiritual growth. That's number one. Number two, the dangers of thinking and talking about spiritual growth is that actually thinking and talking about it actually disconnects us from it. Not only in one way gives us a sense of a substitute, almost fools us that we're in it. That's one thing. But it actually has the other danger that it even pulls us away from it. It even disconnects us from it. How is that possible? Kierkegaard, there's this Yiddish guy, no, Kierkegaard says, pure thinking is treason to the spirit. There's a problem with pure thinking. And this is what he says. Any poet's existence is a sin. Vis-a-vis the sin that one is writing poetry instead of living. That one occupies oneself with God and truth only in one's imagination instead of aiming at experiencing both existentially. That's the problem. We're talking about God. We're filling our imaginations. We're talking about values. We're talking about life. Instead of experiencing it all existentially. And therefore there's a problem that when a person thinks and speaks, they become more disconnected from what they're speaking about. I mean, the very nature of cognition happens by removing yourself, taking distance, observing. But the point is, as you observe life and talk about it and philosophize about it, you're slowly actually pulling yourself away from it, looking at it as if it's over there and you're over here. And therefore, thinking and talking about life and spiritual growth actually stands the danger of removing us from the very experience itself. In addition, Arnold Bergson, who was a Jewish fellow, he's a philosopher, he wasn't a Jewish philosopher, he says something I think very important in his introduction to metaphysics. He says like this, analyzing consists in expressing a thing in terms of what it's not. Brilliant. When you analyze something, when you talk about something, when you philosophize, when you conceptualize, what you're actually doing is you are expressing a thing in terms of what it's not. Do you see the contradiction in it? And therefore he says, all analysis is therefore a translation, a development into symbols. When I talk about life, I'm translating life into symbols, into a metaphor, into concepts, into words. I'm describing life in terms of what it's not. Life is not words, and life is not thoughts, and life is not analysis. And so the paradox of it is, the more I think about life, the more I talk about life, the more I become removed from life itself. Do you hear this? And therefore, I talk about it more and more in terms of what it's not. So for instance, the more I talk about love, the less I'll know of what real life is. The more I talk about meaning, the more removed I become from the experience of what that word meaning was supposed to be pointing to. And the more I talk about God, the less I really know about God. Very interesting. And very, very challenging to me as a person who talks a lot about God and philosophizes a lot about God. Because it has such a danger that actually moves you from God. The more you talk about God, you lose God. You end up with a concept of God. You end up with a word. You end up with a formulation. You end up with these interesting terms which are describing God in terms of what He's not. And you're getting to know what God is not by talking so much about what you think God is. Major problem. Because it's absolutely critical to understand that the concept God does not equal the reality it's pointing to. And yet it's so easy to begin to think it does. So here are two dangers of thinking and talking about spiritual growth, life, God, the whole gamut. Danger number one is that it gives us a feeling that we're actually involved in experiencing and we're really living it. Danger number two is not only does it come as a substitute, but it's just the opposite. It has a tendency of removing us from the very subject matter we're talking about. The philosophy is removed from the subject matter it's really talking about. And so, we can now understand why silence is so important. And why it says, Sayag lechachma shtika. Shtika, sayag lechachma. Silence is a fence to wisdom. We need to know when to be silent. We need to know when to be silent. You know, when people ask me about education, I always say, one of the greatest difficulties as an educator is knowing what not to say. What to say is easy. I guess lots of things to say. Question is what not to say. Much of what an educator needs to be working on is what they edit out, not what they put in. Because silence is that which protects wisdom. Because when we try to analyze and when we try to formulate, we try to express, what are we really trying to do? We're trying to formulate that which we know intuitively. We know God before we knew the word. And we know love before we said the word. And we know meaning before we said the word. And that's the problem. The problem is that sometimes because we're so involved with talking about it, we forget what we actually understood before we knew any words. When I see my son walk down the street and look at the world, I don't know what world he looks at. You know? Because he sees a world that I have somehow filtered out by calling it a bird and calling it a tree and calling it a house. And we somehow get trapped. And sometimes these thoughts and these words separate us from a direct experience, a direct knowing, emerging with the object, is separated and restrained by the intellectualizing, the philosophizing that pulls us more and more away from it. And therefore, silence is absolutely critical. Absolutely critical. Time for silence. Time for silence. Do you hear this? That's what it says. Ashrei Yoshvei Veitecha Od Yaluch HaSela. Happy are those who sit in your house. Forever they will praise you. So the Talmud learns from here a halacha which unfortunately isn't practiced as much as it should be, that before a person prays, they should take a pause, some silence, a pause of silence. And it learns it from this verse. Happy are those who sit in your house. Clearly the Talmud learns this as sits in your house in silence, forever they will praise you. If they sit in your house with silence, come to know you in silence, then forever they will praise you. But if they don't take that time for silence, then they won't forever praise you. Why will they not forever praise you? Because as time goes on, they begin to confuse their praises with whom they're really praising. You follow? They begin to take too seriously what they're saying as if what they're saying can completely capture what they're meaning. Do you follow this? And therefore, if there's silence, and I come to know whom I call God, but whom I call God, come to know before I use the word, then forever I will praise you. There's a major problem. Major, major problem. Sayag. Shtika sayag lechachma. Silence is a protection to wisdom. The inner wisdom. That which I know before it. And that is the meaning of secrets in Judaism. Chachmat ha-sod, when you talk about Kabbalah, everybody knows Kabbalah is referred to as a secret. It's the sod. You know, there's the pshat, there's the simple meaning. There's the drash, there's the more explanatory, there's the remez, there's the hint. But then there's the sod, the secrets. What's a secret? Is a secret simply something that people don't talk about? Or is a secret something that some other people in the world have been talking about, but you're not privy to it? And therefore it's a secret. And you're a little annoyed. Like, how can I don't know the secret? You see, sod, secret, means that even after you've talked about it, it's still a secret. Why? Because no matter what you say, it still won't come close to what it is. And you have to remember that. No matter what I say about God, love, peace, growth, spirituality, their words, their concepts, and they at best point to, suggest, allude, direct me. But essentially, I cannot confuse these words, these concepts, with the reality that they're at best, trying to suggest. That's the secret. After all the books and the poems and the movies and the theater and of thousands of years of mankind talking about love, love is still a secret. That's what makes it so beautiful. It's a secret. It's a secret. A secret isn't something that you haven't spoken about. A secret is something that even after you've spoken about it, you know you still don't understand it conceptually, even though you do know it. We know what love is before we've expressed it, before we've analyzed it, before we've conceptualized it. We know it. It's a secret. And we know it in silence. And so, that's why it says in the Midrash, Sod Hashem li re'av brita la'odia. The secret of God is to those who revere Him. He will reveal to them, He will make known to them His covenant. Now when you read this Midrash, it doesn't make any sense. What are you talking about? Now I know the secret. It just said the secret of God will be to those who revere Him. And you know what He's going to tell those who revere Him? He's going to tell them about the covenant. Ah, so now I know it. I don't know it. I just know the word Brit. But do you know the secret of Brit? Do you know the real secret of that kind of connection with Hashem? That can't be expressed in words. Words can at best suggest, maybe hint to, but that we have to get in touch with inside ourselves through the silence. And so, Rav Simcha Bunim Ipshitzch says a beautiful pshat. Explains, Torah's Hashem Tamima. Everyone knows the verse. The Torah of God is pure. So Rav Simcha Bunim explains, what do you mean it's pure? After the thousands of years of explanation, nobody's ever touched it yet. It's still pure. You think we've explained it, you think we've uncovered it, you think we've revealed it? Nothing. It's still a secret. But what about all these books? What about all these books and all these explanations and all these commentaries? It's still only scratching the surface. Because words and concepts can only scratch the surface. And then we have to go beneath it to the silence. That's what they talk about when they talk about the Kol Dmama. Yechezkel heard the silent voice. That's the highest experience. What I know in silence is what I know intuitively. I know love intuitively. I know God intuitively. I know life intuitively. Maybe I can express it. Maybe I can't. But even after I express it, I have to be so careful not to think that I've captured it, not to think that now I understand it, not to think that I'm actually living it because I've expressed it. I live it in my inner heart, in my silence. And so, there's another danger in speech and thinking. Speech and thinking leads to substituting for the real life experience. And speech and thought can lead to actually disconnecting us from life experience. And speech and thought causes us to forget secrets. To forget what I actually know inside. Because I talk so much about it, I forgot what it really was. Do you hear this? I've talked so much about God, and of course, by definition, talking about God is talking about God in terms of what He's not. Because what can be compared to God? And therefore, the more I talk about God, the more I talk about God in terms of what He's not, the less I know about God. So talking and cognating and philosophizing has the danger, once again, of causing us to forget the very secret we're trying to express. In this I heard a beautiful pshat. Everybody knows that when you're in your mother's womb, you learn the whole Torah. You remember that? I remember when my wife and I went for a ultrasound, right, to see the baby inside. And so the fellow turns to me and he says, want to know what sex the baby is? I said, I don't want to know the sex. I just want to know what tractate of Talmud he's studying. So I thought, you know, they're gonna zoom in and I'm going to see my kid going, Abba Yeses, Abba. You know, and if they're twins, mamish, they'd probably be a machlokes. Right? So I thought, oh, you know, and people think, what does it mean? They're learning Torah. You know, baby's learning Torah in the mother's stomach. Now everybody knows that there's these funny angels. You know, what can I say? Angels with interesting sense of humor. Because just as you're about to come into this world, and let the world know all the secrets of the universe that this angel taught you. This angel then touches you right here, and you forget it. And you come out, and you're about to deliver the most brilliant speech, and you come out and go, and that takes you so long just to say, Abba, Ima, you know. Funny angel, no? But it's a very bizarre Talmud. I learn all this Torah, and the angel touches me here, and I forget it. Well, I heard a fantastic pshat. Why doesn't the angel touch me here, and I forget it? Why does the angel touch me on my mouth? Because you know how I forget it? By trying to talk about it. Do you hear this? You see, the human being comes in the world, and this is the tension that we're working towards, and we need to speak. There's dangers in speaking. There's dangers in thinking, in cognating, in formulating, expressing. But what can we do? We're a medaber. That's what we are. You've got mineral. You've got vegetable. You've got animal. But what is the human being referred to in Torah? The medaber. The speaker. Right? The speaker. We can't help but come into the world and we want to speak. And yet the very desire to speak and the very attempt to speak and formulate and express causes us to forget secrets. The secrets of what we know inside before the word that can't be fully expressed in any word. And so we come into this world and we need to speak about life. We need to speak about growth. We need to speak about God. And the more we speak about it, the more we substitute living it by speaking it. We pull ourselves away from it. We talk about life and God in terms of what it's not, and we become less and less familiar with God and life and meaning. I remember one of my teachers said, you know how you can tell a Baal Tshuva? I'm a Baal Tshuva too. But he says, I can tell a Baal Tshuva, he's the guy trying to talk to somebody about God at the bus stop. So I heard my rabbi say this once. I thought, that's so cynical. Wow, Baal Tshuva is talking about God at a bus stop. That's ridiculous. Sure enough, after I talk to him, standing at a bus stop, and this guy standing there, you know, and he goes up to a perfect stranger, says, hi, where are you from? How you doing? How long are you in Jerusalem? Do you believe in God? Well, I'm actually just waiting for the one bus, but do you believe in the one? Do you believe in the one? Everything, I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, do you really think this is what we should be doing? You see, if you talk about God at a bus stop, then something's wrong. There's a certain lack of sensitivity because talking about anything, especially God, meaning life, is so serious and so dangerous that you want to make sure that it's conveyed in the right way, that you don't cause the guy to forget God because you've convinced him that this is God. It's all in. Okay, that's God. I don't believe in God. That's the problem. And Rav Kook talks about the tendency of talking about God so much causes people to disbelieve in God. Because they end up with a concept which is clearly not God. But they start to think that the concept, the word G-O-D is God, and they say, I don't believe in God. They forget the secrets. They forget the secrets they should know in silence. And this is a major problem. We talk too much. We philosophize too much. We conceptualize too much. And speech, therefore, causes us great pain. And philosophizing, conceptualizing causes us great pain. What's the pain? Rav Kook explains that we have illuminations. Great lights are flashing within us. Brilliant revelations within us. And then we try to stuff it into words. And there's a clash between the life experience and the very small word I'm trying to put it in. It's like the experience where you love somebody so much in that special, special moment. When you're so alive and you're so connected. You look at this person and you say, I love you. And then you feel stupid. You say, oh my gosh, why did I say that? I'm sorry. I didn't say that. You didn't say that? No, I didn't say it. You mean you don't love me? Well, I knew. I don't. I mean, what did I just do? We knew something in silence. But then the medaber in me, I have to speak. I'm a human being. We're medabers. And so I want to express it. But what happens? I take all this light, which cannot be pushed into these little words. and I shove it into a little word called L-O-V-E, which is being so abused and so misused and so misunderstood. But I'm stuck. I'm a medaper. What can I do? I need to talk. I need to express. And yet, what I know, in silence, I can't really, really say in words. But I have to. And that's the question. I have to. Speech and thought and philosophizing has many, many dangers. And there's a pain. Rav Kook refers to in one of his poems as an endless pain of expression. To have to stick to this piece of paper. To have to even put it through this pen. To use the very finite verbiage that we have available to tell me what the expanses of my soul has to say. You know, it's known that in the writings of Rav Kook, in the original transcripts, many of the pages he goes off the page. Right? He wasn't even aware of the margins of the page. He would write onto the table. Because he couldn't even be that bounded to even the page. Because what we know in silence is so much greater than what we can say in words, and yet we seem to be forced to say in words. This is the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, everyone knows, has a speech impediment. And most of us are aware of the fact, well, he had this test, they were claiming to the king that there's a possibility that this fellow's going to grow up and try and undermine his kingdom. And so instead of going for the coal, instead of going for the gold, he went for the coal. The angel pushed him. That's a midrash, we take it seriously. But there's another understanding that the Maharal brings down. The Maharal explains the reason why he was covered, but his mouth was heavy, because he knew so much in silence. That was so hard for him to say in words. That's why he stuttered. He just couldn't say it in words. He had such an understanding of life, so deep, that he understood that he could not really convey this conceptually, philosophically. And therefore, he stuttered. It was hard for him. And so, you know, one of the things we see in Torah is the holier something is, the less spoken about. That's when you know you're really dealing with holiness. That's when you know you're really dealing with holiness. As you see even the commentaries of Judaism as the years go on, they become more and more talkative. They talk more and more. But if you go to the Rishonim, Rashi says what he wants to say, 3 words. He said it. And we have to figure out what he said in 3 words. He was able to take so much and just put it into 3 words. But that's the nature of language. Most of us familiar with the fact that the word for word, teva, means box. That's what language is. And the word for word, mila, the Hebrew word for word is also mila, means to cut, like a brit mila. And another word for word is dvarim, which means things, just to show how limited language and concepts are. What did Jews involve themselves in? Halacha, we want to know what to do. And so it's not uncommon. I meet people coming from the East or coming from India or coming and looking for a spiritual experience. And they're Jewish. They come and they say, you know, Rabbi, I'm a spiritual person. I want to understand the spirituality that Judaism has to offer me. Show me your sanctuary of God consciousness. Right? I mean, I've been meditating and I've been levitating and I've been involved with all kinds of spiritual ecstatic experiences. What does Judaism have to offer me? And so you take him into a Beit Midrash and he walks in. This is supposed to be the sanctuary of Jewish life. And what does he see? He sees these guys yelling at each other. You know, like, the guy walks in and says, this is Judaism? This is Judaism? I mean, in the temples that I'm at, there's silence. We meditate. We sit cross-legged. And here are people yelling at each other. Right? It's hard. And then he listens into the conversation. What happens if a cow knocks over a plant and a plant hits a cat and a cat screeches and a person falls down and breaks his glasses? Who pays? And this guy's looking for, like, you know, hey, where do we, what is this? You see, that's how we say God. The most direct way of saying what you know in silence about God is to know who pays. Because if you don't know who pays, you don't know God. A person who lives with God, not just talks about God, not just thinks about God, but lives with God is concerned with who pays, who's responsible. How do I live my life with God? Not just talking about God. That's the highest spiritual experience in Judaism. That's how we talk about God. It's through halacha. It's through our way of living, not simply talking and philosophizing, conceptualizing. That's so dangerous. And yet we need to do it. And yet we have to be careful of the dangers and the risks in it. A friend of mine came into town. He was a very spiritual fellow. And he asks me, what does Judaism have to offer in spirituality? So we brought them to Rabbi Getz, Zichron Elevracha, who was a great Kabbalist. And Rabbi Getz was known all night long. He'd be in the tunnels of the Kotel. And he'd be studying Kabbalah all night long. This fellow wants to meet a Kabbalist. He wants to know the secrets. And he comes up to this Kabbalist and he says to him, Rabbi, what does Judaism have to offer me? I've been involved with really unusual experiences in the East, and I would like to know what does Judaism have to offer me. Rabbi gets turned to him and says, well, all we have is love your neighbor as yourself. In summary, there are dangers to philosophizing, conceptualizing, formulating, expressing. They can turn into a substitute for life. They can actually withdraw us from life. They can even cause us to forget life. And it creates a great spiritual pain because what I know inside is being stuffed into concepts which are too rigid and too small for what I know in silence. So you know what we're really talking about here? This is really the relation between faith and intellect. What is the role of faith in Judaism? What is the role of intellect? And how do they interconnect? So basically, people think that faith, when a person has faith, it's because they don't know. So they have faith that it's true. You follow? When people talk about faith, it's generally understood, well, I can't figure this out. I can't really understand this. I can't even prove this. And therefore, I have faith that it's true. That's not what Judaism is talking about when it says emunah. That's stupidity. That's not emunah. What is emunah? Emunah is actually considered to be the highest form of knowledge. Because emunah, faith, is so high, it has no words. It's so high, it has no explanations. That's why it's so high. Intellect has words. Intellect has explanations. But intellect comes to express what faith knows before the words. What faith knows intuitively. What I know inside. I just know. How do I know I exist? I know. Explain it to me? I can't. Prove it to me? I can't. Well, then you don't know. But I do know. That's faith. I know. I know there's Hashem. How do I know? I know there's love. How do I know? I know there's meaning. How do I know? I don't know how I know. But I know. And the fact that I can't explain how I know doesn't mean I don't know. It just means I can't explain it. And the truth is that if I could explain it, it wouldn't be so high. It would only be in the world of words and concepts. But this is much higher. It's what I know in the inside before words, before concepts. And therefore, it's absolutely critical to understand that there is no conflict between faith and intellect. It's not as if faith is not knowing, intellect is knowing, faith is not proving, intellect is certainty through proof. It's just the opposite in Judaism. It's intellect that has doubts. It's intellect that doesn't know, so tries to figure out, tries to formulate, tries to prove. But faith knows inside 100%. I know because I know. How do I know? I don't know. But I do know. That's faith. That's emunah. Intellect comes to express what I know intuitively in words. I have to be very careful that when I'm philosophizing and conceptualizing and explaining what I know intuitively, I don't lose what I knew intuitively. Do you follow? I remember one fellow came into yeshiva, told me he knew God, he believed in God, then he went to these classes on philosophy and proofs of God, he came out not believing in God. I couldn't believe it. You know? This particular yeshiva, for this fellow, did the opposite. He walked away not believing in God. Because what he knew before the word and before the proofs and before the concepts got muddled away, and he started to think, oh, then I don't know God. This is God, and that's God. I don't believe in God. Right? And you shouldn't believe in that. That's a concept. That's not God. And so it's very important to understand that intellect expresses faith, articulates faith, formulates faith. Because I'm a medaber and I'm looking to express it. And yet I have to be so careful that I don't lose it and forget it while I was in the process of expressing it. And so it's important to understand that emunah, faith, is also the basis of intellect. You don't have intellect without faith. Because basically you believe in logic. That's faith. I believe in logic. I believe in the rational. My belief in rationality is irrational. Why do you believe in rational? I don't know, I just know. I know there's meaning to something logical. How do you know there's meaning to something logical? I just know. That's emunah, once again. That's really the irrational, or let's call it, essentially, it's the super-rational to the rational. Emunah is the basis of intellect. And intellect only comes to try and express it. 2 + 2 = 4. I know that that's rational. How do you know that? You don't know. I know that. How do you know that? That's emunah. That's, I believe in logic. I have faith in intellect. That's the whole point. But I can't prove that intellect is sound. I believe it's sound. I believe it's important. I believe it has value. But it's still belief. And therefore, when a person says, oh, I'm not a believer, I'm an intellect. There's no such thing. We're all believers. The very fact that you believe in intellect is believing. And how do you believe in intellect? How do you know intellect is meaningful? I know there's meaning to intellect. I know there's danger to intellect. But I have to understand it. And so this is the relationship. Faith is really inner knowledge. It's knowledge before the word. I know God before I say the word. I know love before I say the word. That's emunah. Intellect is saying the word. Intellect is formulating it. Intellect is articulating it. Intellect is analyzing it. Through faith, I have a direct experience. Through emunah, I know God experientially, existentially. Faith is an existential condition. Intellect is a philosophical concept that I have. And faith, I know in silence, intellect tries to bring out in speech. And this is the relation between being a participant and being an observer. Faith is participating in life. I know myself because I'm involved with myself. I know God because I'm involved with God. I know life because I'm involved with life. Whether I can explain life, if I can't explain it, I know it because I'm involved. But intellect is observing life. Intellect has to take steps back to look at life and describe it and understand it. And yet faith seeks to merge with life. And there's this tension over here now. Because faith is seeking to merge with what it knows. Because it knows through participation. I know love by being in love. Intellect knows love through observing love. I remember I saw on the front page, I think it was Time or Newsweek years ago, it says, the scientific explanation of love. That's the end of love. That's the end of love. They have a whole scientific, psychological understanding of what love is. That might be an interesting intellectual attempt to express a little bit of something. But love is a secret. And it should remain a secret. But we should try to express it. And so, this is really a relation between the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. The tree of knowledge was intellect. The tree of knowledge was cognating good and bad. The tree of life, Rav Simcha Bunim explains, the tree of knowledge, the tree of life, man also knew good and evil. What, man didn't know good and bad? Of course he knew good and bad. But the good and bad that you know from the tree of life is something you know from inside. And the good and bad you know from the tree of knowledge is something you know from outside. From external knowledge. And that's what changed. Man knew good, not by philosophizing about it, explaining it, figuring it out, proving it, giving it some kind of logic. Man knew good because he knew good like he knew himself. He knew good through participating in goodness rather than looking at it and trying to describe it. And therefore, the Midrash that says that God created man straight, but they asked for many accountings, many complexities, that's exactly the point. Man is born with faith. The baby has emunah. The baby knows love, even though he can't explain it to you. He can't describe it, he can't formulate it, but babies know love, and you can feel they know love. But part of growing up is I want to cognate it. I want to explain it. I want to express it. I want to understand it in conceptual terms. That's part of growing up. And therefore, man eats from the tree of knowledge of good and bad, which means he eats from the fruit of intellect. And that's okay, and it would have been okay, had he not separated, according to the Kabbalah, between the tree of knowledge and the tree of life. The Kabbalah says, had they eaten it as a fruit salad, it would have been fine. But he separated intellect from faith. External, conceptual, analytical knowledge from intuitive, experiential, inner knowledge. And if you separate those two, you lose life. You gain a concept. You have a philosophy. But you lose life. So one last point. So if thinking and philosophizing and talking is so dangerous, so why do we do it? Why do we do it? Because we have to do it. We have to do it. That's how we become human beings and not animals. Because the way we become conscious of ourselves, the way we achieve self-awareness, is by stepping out of ourselves. The way we become aware of life, we might instinctively know life, but we're not aware of life until we actually step out of life. You see, a cat also knows happiness. You've seen that. I'm sure you see the happy cat or a happy dog. Say, there's a happy dog. Right? And you look at this dog and say, that's a happy dog. How come I'm not happy? You see, there's a difference. That dog is happy, but he doesn't know he's happy. Right? Right? Because he cannot think about it. He intuits. He instinctively is happy. He's participating in a state of being of happiness. But because he cannot cognate, because he cannot walk out philosophically and conceptually and look at it, he doesn't know he's happy. Do you see the crazy? That's life, you know? What can you say? You might be involved in life, but how do you know you're in life until you get out of life? And so we have this tension in our lives. A dog is happy. He's instinctively, intuitively happy. He might say on a very low level, he's got faith in happiness, right? But he doesn't have intellectual understanding of happiness because he can't walk out of it. So he's happy, but he doesn't know he's happy, right? But we have the ability to be happy and know we're happy. How do we know we're happy? Because we can walk out of ourselves and look at it. And yet, there's a price we pay. We remove ourselves from the experience. As soon as we walk out of happiness, we're not happy. Do you follow this? Right? As you walk out of happiness to become aware of happiness, you've just walked out of the experience of happiness. So you know what I gotta do? You gotta walk right back in. But if I walk back in, I become just simply an instinctive being involved in experience. How am I aware of it? You walk right out. This is the dance of life. You've gotta be in life and out of life at the same time. You've got to be into it with your emunah, and you have to let your intellect take you out of it for a second to be able to look at it. But not so long that you stop looking at it and start looking at the concept and beginning to think it's the concept. See, that's the problem. This leads to tremendous depression. When people start thinking about the meaning of life, I promise you, the more you think about the meaning of life, the less meaningful life will be. Because that's not life, that's a concept. And the concept life is meaningless. It's a meaningless concept. Ah. So what do? I'm thinking about life. What's the meaning of life? How do I understand the meaning of life? What's the purpose of life? And I start talking about life. And then when I talk about life and think about life, slowly I get out of life and I'm feeling depressed. And I end up with this fantastic philosophy, but I feel bummed out. Because I am out. So this is what's going on. The intuition wants to understand by participating and bonding and merging with life experience. The intellect pulls us away from that to look at it, to cognate it, to conceptualize it. And this is really the dance of life. This is the dance of awareness. And essentially, I realized that that's basically perhaps what Avram said when he said, Ger v'toshav anochi. I am a stranger and a settler. Now, how do you become a stranger and a settler at the same time? That's our life. We are both strangers and settlers. We are in life, and yet we have to be out of life to be aware that we're in life. And so, if you're out of it too long, you get depressed. You talk about the meaning of happiness and how can a person be happy. The greatest way of becoming depressed is talking too much about being happy. And you'll find out that when you don't talk about happy, all of a sudden one day you say, hey, you know, I think I'm happy. Oh, now I'm bummed out. Right? But that's okay because now I'm aware of it. I go right back in. I go out. I go in. This is really the movement of life. This is really the movement of life. I remember a story in Eastern book, Hindu, Buddhist type of book. And they have this little story about the centipede and the frog. So the frog was trying to catch the centipede. And so he could never catch the centipede because the centipede walks so fast. So he turns to the centipede and he says, Mr. Centipede, could you, one second please. So the centipede stops. And the frog turns to him and says, Mr. Centipede, I can never catch you. I'm going to stop even trying. But just tell me one thing. When you walk, which foot do you put first? Well, the centipede stopped. He thought about it and could never walk again. That's this Eastern story. But it's Eastern, it's not Jewish. Right? I'll tell you what's not Jewish about it. There's something very true about it. The centipede is intuition. The centipede is being in life. Being instinctively involved in life. I'm spontaneously walking. I don't understand how I walk. I never thought about how I walk. I never tried to cognate what goes first, what goes second. How does this work? Why does this work? I just do it. I'm doing it and it's great. But the frog is intellect. The frog says, wait a second. Think. Just think a second. Tell me intellectually. Explain to me. Think about this. Cognate. How do you walk? From that day on, the centipede couldn't walk. But now the centipede for the first time was probably aware of the fact that he knew how to walk. But now he can't walk. You see, the Torah would say, now you got to forget about how you walk. This is the interesting thing. You have to remember, you have to cognate, you look at the way you walk, you understand what it means to walk, and then you forget, and then you remember. This, I think, right now, it's hitting me. There's a midrash that says that Moshe Rabbeinu went up to get the Torah. He remembered it, he forgot it, he remembered it, he forgot it. Right? That's how you're in and out. That's how you're in and out. You forget how you walk, now you can walk naturally. You're not cognating, you're not outside of yourself. But basically what Torah is asking of us, life is asking of us, spiritual growth demands. We have to be in life, participating in life, understanding life not through words or concepts, but intuitively, before the word, before the concept, in silence. But then we're not aware. We're like animals. We don't have consciousness. And so we have to pull out of it and look at it and become observers. And the dance of life is to be simultaneously a participant and an observer. The balance between silence and speaking it out, but not losing what I know in silence. The relationship between having the emunah, the deep intuitive knowledge, and yet being able to cognate and to describe and to philosophize without losing the simplicity of what I knew in my silence. This is the dance. This is the challenge. This is the end.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4000. 4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.